Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Second Time Founders podcast. We have Adam Fishman here. I don't know, Adam, do you want to give like an intro
of yourself, because
Sarah wants to intro you?
Like your bio is
pretty lengthy and crazy.
You're doing so many different things, so you need to just do what you do.
This is where LinkedIn fails me. So right now, what am I doing? Right now, I am helping the team at Mozilla with their product strategy and building a stronger execution muscle for product. My background is in building companies, unfortunately not as the founder, unless you count my own business, which is a thing, but being kind of like a good number two. And so I did that across a bunch of businesses, Zimride, which became Lyft, some ed tech, a lot of marketplaces, Patreon, Imperfect Foods. And I did that from a perspective of growth and product. And then I went out on my own and hung up my shingle and, just started helping other companies, without being a full-time employee inside the business. And then, I started a little media business. Pretty far away from an empire. But I have a newsletter where I take some of the things that I actually work with companies on and try to teach them to other people because I can't be everywhere and hopefully somebody benefits from it. So a lot around like building company culture and how to think about how to grow or how to talk to customers or sort of all those things you need to do when you're trying to build and grow a company. And then I started a podcast, which has nothing to do with all that other stuff. It's called Startup Dad. And I interviewed Sarah and her lesser half on the show once. But I interview...
I disagree.
But I interview, so the premise is, I feel like there's a lot of people who interview female founders and CEOs, and the first thing that they ask them is not, how are you so successful in business and tell me about your company, but it's about their family and things like that. Right. And the opposite is actually not true when men are interviewed. Usually it's like, tell me about how you're killing it at your company. And how you've scaled this massive business and how you're so amazing at business. Right. And so I felt like there was an opportunity to have a different conversation with those folks because a lot of them are killing it at work and not necessarily killing it at home. And so, Startup Dad is, I interview entrepreneurs, founders, CEOs, product executives, interesting creative types. And instead of talking about work and business, we talk about parenthood and fatherhood, and we cover some pretty meaty topics. We talked, Sarah, to you and your hubs about cancer, about what it was like for him to come work for you, all that stuff. And I just talked to somebody about male fertility, which was a thing. I've talked to people about like losing kids. I've talked to people about divorce. I've talked to people about parenting frameworks and all kinds of stuff. And so I've done about almost 50 episodes now. Always amazed that there's new topics to talk about every single time. So this week's episode is going to be teaching dads to cook. So I'm talking to a guy who's kind of starting a little side business about cooking and like how to get more men involved in the kitchen and like participating in the household in that regard and being more comfortable doing it. And he's got like a system and framework for like how to think about planning and shopping and doing the cooking and stuff like that. And I'm just like, wow, this is amazing. So let's teach other people this. That's it. That's what I do.
I love your podcast so much. I love listening to it. It's so true. Men never get you know, these successful men in tech never get interviewed about being a dad and their family life and how they manage it all. And so it's so refreshing to hear that. And also, like, sometimes, you know, hear what they're not doing at home right. and what they've had to give up to, you know, achieve that level of success. You hear, you know, some of them do have, you know, maybe a stay-at-home parent or a primary parent that is not them. So it's I love hearing about that side and how you interview them too is so interesting and digging into tough topics that kind of get beyond the surface. You also recently had a friend of mine, Luke Millar, who's like, he's actually a dad I respect as a dad. His five kids and he's awesome.
Yeah.
And like, I feel like I worked with him back in the day when he was just a lowly old engineer at Twitter, and I like knew he was the most talented person I've ever worked with. Like, he's just so smart and so good at working with people too. And he like taught me how to code Android, and like, he just taught me all this stuff, and he didn't have to do that. And I was like, when is this guy gonna like make it big and get recognized professionally? And now he's a really high up person at Medium and on their board and just doing amazing things and killing it both in dad life and professional life. So I'm like, I'm so happy he's like finally getting the recognition and fame he deserves.
Yeah.
That is an episode everyone should listen to.
First dad to cry on the show too.
Whoa.
Which is not my goal. I didn't know that's where we were going.
He's a top all around guy.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and I think like I have to disclaim, I'm not interviewing folks from the position of expertise. Like,
right.
I don't want anyone to think that I have anything figured out. Like, I've got a couple kids. I made a lot of mistakes when my kids were younger and I was like running hard at companies and, you know, have a lot of regrets from some of those decisions. And if I could rewind time, I'd do some things differently. So now I think what I'm trying to do is get all that stuff out so that people can learn and can maybe just realize the trade-offs that they're making, because you don't necessarily in the moment appreciate all that stuff until you look back at it on it and you're like, why did I not spend any time with my kids when my company was growing? All I cared about was building my company.
Right.
And I think that's fine, but almost everybody that I talk to about it has regrets there, if that's their approach.
And
so
Andy, who is here, is not a dad, but hopefully will be one day if we can convince him to have kids. All the rest of us can rub off on him. So he needs to listen to it to kind of learn what not to do and what to do.
Yeah.
What do you think, Andy? Have we pressured you into having kids yet?
No comment.
Andy's like, I've got one right here.
Thing, like, I get, Andy, have you ever been asked in like a professional interview, like on a podcast or something like that, like when, like your family planning, like, are you going to have kids? Like, because that's a thing that a lot of women get asked, like, you know, do you want to be a mom one day? Like, if they're not yet a mom, or how are you thinking about that? And like, I feel like men also never get asked that.
I get asked it in a professional setting all the time. I've just never gotten asked it on a podcast.
Okay.
I'm not exactly young.
Now we're asking. Turn the two. Instead of trying to get people not to ask women those questions, we're just instead going to ask men.
Yeah. Level the playing.
All the questions.
Yeah. Like, Kevin, when you're raising funding for one or more of your companies, did anyone say like, I don't know, Kevin, you're in those prime childbearing years. Like, how are you going to do it? Where's my money going?
Definitely. Actually, sometimes
okay.
if over Zoom when you're trying to raise money, and then like if like an investor's at home and then like their kid comes in and it's like, I have two kids too, but usually they don't ask at all.
No.
But sometimes it just kind of comes up naturally and you could kind of like bond over that a little bit. But yeah, you definitely do not get asked that. I can only imagine how many women get asked that. Hopefully not in like an interview
I think they more just assume like
right, it's unspoken.
Have kids, or you have to go out of your way to like be like, oh, I'm done having kids.
Right, right.
Now it's very convincing because I'm too old. I feel like
I don't know.
Have to go out of my way before to be like, I'm really not having any more kids. Really.
It's done.
Adam, how did the podcast come about? Was it just like a passion project? And like give us a sense of like, is it just you? Do you have a team? Like, is this something that you're making any money off of? Or
well, hopefully at some point I will make some money off of it. Right now it's a labor of love for sure.
Yeah.
It's something that I get a lot of enjoyment out of. And it's kind of like, I guess in a way it's like starting a company. Like you shouldn't start something that you're not going to be excited and passionate about. Otherwise it's going to be a slog. I actually enjoy the podcast probably more than anything else I do in life.
That's awesome.
Professionally. And it came about, I think, well, like a lot of people in the pandemic, I was like sitting in my room working all day long at a desk. And I was like, I had wanted to do it. I wanted to like do something. And I thought I was really going to interview and write like long form interviews for my newsletter on that topic. And then I was like, you know, I'm better on camera than writing. Like maybe we should turn this into like
for podcast.
Yeah, like maybe I should turn this into a dialogue. And
Sarah's gonna cross the line here in about a second.
It's all good. We're there. Face for radio. And so I was like, well, you know what? Let me just record a bunch of these things. And so I recorded them. The earliest ones, the quality is so crappy. Like it's from like a bad webcam. I didn't have a microphone. I was like using my AirPods, and it's fine. There's probably like a dachshund barking in the background because my neighbors have barky dog. And so I recorded a bunch, and I'm like, okay, cool. I'll get in and I'll just edit them, and it'll be great. And I'll use the script, and everyone can do this, right? And I started to edit the first one, and I was like, wow, I'm really bad at this, at editing. And so
no
like,
one is good at script editing.
No, it's terrible.
It's hard.
So I had like 10 of these recorded episodes, and I was like, I don't know what to do. It took me like 2 hours to like play around with Descript, and I ended up about 5 minutes into the episode, and I was like, this is not gonna work. So I found an editor. Actually a guy who used to work with Lenny Richisky for his podcast.
Lenny referred
me to Tommy Heron, and Tommy did Lenny's podcast for a while, and he's like a Grammy award winning audio engineer. And he's also a dad. And I started working with him, and I was like, here you go. Here's some raw footage. And he came back in like a week and was like, what do you think of this? And I was like, that is amazing. Like, you're a wizard. So I started working with him, and then I have, cause for my like consulting advisory business, I have a little part-time EA that I work with through this service called Squared Away, it was a very cool service, employs, military spouses. And because it's really hard to hold down a job if you are moving from military base to military base. So it's all virtual, and they all work kind of part-time, and they're super organized because they have to be. And so I started working with this woman to help me with other things. And then I kind of brought her into like a podcast production kind of process. And so she, between her and Tommy and myself, like we make it happen. And I've been thinking about piecing together another thing for making like sizzle clips and stuff like that, because it's not really Tommy's expertise. So I'm trying to figure it out. But like, you know, it's crazy in the year 2024, how difficult it still is to like make and upload a podcast. Like there's like, it's bananas. Like technology should have solved this a long time ago. And it's still a pain, huge pain.
The problem isn't a technology problem. It's actually like a business model problem. So at the end of the day, this is something that you can easily solve with technology, with state-of-the-art models. Right. But are you going to pay more than $19 a month for it? No.
Right.
So what's the point of investing in this?
Right. And I sink a lot of money and effort into the podcast that doesn't pay me anything. So
exactly. let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah.
So this role you have with Mozilla, is that like a fractional role or is it a full-time kind of interim role?
It's full-time interim, which has definitely made it harder to actually not do the podcast because that is a pretty good machine. Like I record and then it goes off and things happen and then it comes back. Like I have a whole system there.
Right.
What's made it harder to do is write, to be honest.
Huh.
Because for writing, you need like big chunks of uninterrupted time.
Right.
To research, to interview people, to like get quotes, to stitch together thoughts and build connections. Right. And so like writing a good newsletter article will take me dozens of hours. Like not all at once, but like stitched together. And so that finding that time is really hard now because I just don't have it.
Yeah.
So,
I think you have a lot of listeners who, you know, are not in the fortunate position of, you know, folks like Andy and Kevin and, you know, even me to some extent that we can, that they can just raise a bunch of money for their company, their new idea kind of off the bat. And so a lot of folks are trying to get creative about how do I start this new thing? I mean, in your case, it's a media empire.
You're going to keep using that word. I'm not sure.
But whether it's a side project or a full-blown company, like you need some money to get started.
Yeah.
And not everyone has, you know, their own, you know, treasure chest to pull out of. So they need to bootstrap this somehow. So I think, you know, what you're doing, kind of consulting, originally it was on the side, now it's full time. Like how do you think about that? Is there a point where you're going to go back to, you know, just doing that kind of consulting on the side and not your full-time gig?
Yeah, so it's almost like running a little services business to kind of finance your startup, which is a bit what I'm doing. I go through cycles where I do full-time interim stuff that, you know, pays pretty well. And then I try to make hay while the sun is shining, as they say. So I try to bank, but you know, I have a life and expenses and, you know, my spouse also works, but like we live in the Bay Area. It ain't cheap. We got two kids. That ain't cheap.
No.
And so like we try to bank as much money as possible when, you know, the interim gigs are going and then, you know, downshift a little bit into something that is a lot more fractional or a lot more part-time after maybe a year or so. So I've done a couple of these cycles of interim gigs. Every time I've done them, something has gotten sacrificed in my other world. And it's usually not family stuff because I don't want to make that sacrifice. So it's often like I'll write a little less or I won't be able to take on any other interesting work or something like that. Or actually I'll just be more stressed, which I don't love. But, you know, I could do it for 6 to 12 months. That's kind of how I make it work. It is very disruptive for periods of time when I do jump back into the fray because I do a lot of the primary schlepping of children around in our life. Right. And my wife's a lawyer. Like she bills on 6-minute increments.
Right.
Like that's a non-starter.
I am also married to a lawyer, Adam. I could talk about that.
You know it, Andy. You know what it's like.
You will never win an argument.
I haven't in 22 years, even before she was a lawyer.
No tonic.
So I do a lot of that stuff. And then like suddenly it's like people want a lot more of my time. And I have to like find ways to protect that time. And we don't have a lot of the systems set up for some anymore. For someone else to step in and help with that.
Right.
And so it's always a huge adjustment when I jump back into the fray and I'm suddenly like full time or even more than full time. It's been, you know, it's it kind of throws our lives into upheaval for a period of time.
Adam, I'd love to hear, like, there's so many, and I also saw on your LinkedIn that you're an investor out of 20VC, right? Their growth fund.
Yes.
Which famously was started by Harry Stemmings, and I'm a big listener of his, and I don't know how many thousands of episodes.
I think we've all got invited to be on his podcast and then ghosted. That's what we all have in common, right?
I'll give him
dead serious with you, because Sarah's not lying. Like, I know so many people he's ghosted, sent emails to, begged for favors, and
it's
he just doesn't follow up. What's his deal, Adam?
You know, I see him every couple weeks on a call, one call. I do know he's got a whole like production company behind this. So
yeah,
I don't know, but I'm gonna give him shit the next time I see him, which might be Friday.
Forget that he ghosted us. To be honest,
there was a group text.
He didn't really have to do that, but he did.
I actually will go one step further. I recorded an episode when I was at Chip, and he never actually aired it.
Ooh,
but. I actually, one of the episodes, he went into that, and he says that he only actually publishes, I think it was either a third or half of the episodes he records, mm-hmm. because he wants the quality that high. And that, like, that sucks for me because I wasn't on it. But, like, you got to give him respect, because, like, he runs it. You could obviously tell a very, very tight ship. But my question was, obviously our audience is, like, first-time founders. And so, yeah. How do you, like, one of the really hard problems that they have to solve is, like, how do you raise money? How do you recruit people? Like, how do you, like, just, and one of the things you could do is, like, kind of build, like, your own personal brand. So that could be on Twitter. That could be through creating a podcast. That could be through anything. Like, how do you, and obviously it just kind of, like, molds together everything. And that's, like, frankly, that's why, I personally wanted to do our podcast. It's like, we have amazing hosts on. I learn a shitload. And we're also, like, helping other founders, which is also, like, a passion of mine. And also, like, to be, for my own personal, we've got quite a few subscribers and views and all that. And so it kind of, like, helps with my kind of notoriety and all of that, building my personal brand. How do you see, like, this next generation? Before, like, early on, it was like blogging, like, yeah, like the Fred Wilsons of the world, and they would make a name for themselves, and there was a lot of, like, open source founders and stuff like that. Like, how do you kind of see, like, this new, like, age media in the worlds of, like, founders of companies or people in the technology field or something like that working together?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think, like, you are doing this podcast, Sarah, you're very active on Twitter. And you've got, I think you still do your Friday parenting roll up and stuff. No, it's
phased
it
out. Well, it's really,
it was right after I made the cut, and then it was it.
Well, Twitter, I just don't get any engagement anymore.
Twitter sucks now.
So I really moved a lot of my stuff to LinkedIn, and the format for LinkedIn is very different. So I do post stuff about parenting and childcare, but it's in the, like, LinkedIn format and on their kind of frequency.
Yeah. I think there's, like, a couple of things. So one is what you just mentioned, Sarah, is a tough thing for folks. Like, you can go build, you have a pretty decent Twitter audience, you know, and then all of a sudden, like, that's not useful to you anymore.
Yep.
Like, you can't get engagement. Nobody's seeing your stuff. And I mean, I pay Elon $9 a month or whatever stupid fee he has for my blue check mark, because it seemed like that was what I had to do. And I don't know. I mean, I don't invest very much in that platform anymore, because it's just, like, nobody cares. I do think, though, that there's value. I think there's a couple things. One is, you know, the advice that I've heard a lot is, like, oh, you shouldn't spend any time on social media because you should just be building your company.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, okay. But I actually like the perspective that I heard about this that I really like was Claire Vaux, who's a product builder. She's CPO at LaunchDarkly. She built ChatPRD and, like, a few other things. And she's like, look, I am out on social media because that's, like, the job. Like, it's how I recruit. It's how I stay connected to the ecosystem. It's how I get feedback on the things that I'm working on. It's how I talk to customers. It's how I, you know, it's like a release for me. And I actually think that's a much healthier way of thinking about it, which is the presence that you build online is one, is it's the new media. Like giving an interview with like Forbes doesn't do a whole lot for you anymore. But
it's a paywall too. No, it's not a lot of people are going to see it.
Exactly. But you know, talking about your mission and the reason that the reason to believe in your company and living that, that those values out is going to help you with so many things. One, it's going to get you, I think, crisper on your position of your company and why you're doing the work, and you're going to get whether or not you like it feedback, which is a gift, even if it's angry people with torches and pitchforks on Twitter or whatever. And then the other thing is like, it's going to show, especially when, I think when you're a founder and like your job is to recruit the best possible people you can, like you can't give that, you can't fire the money cannon in their direction. Like, you know, you're not paying FANG level wages to folks. And you also don't necessarily want those types of folks. You want people who are as bought into what you're doing as you are. And the way you find those people is they follow your exploits online. And, you know, so I think that you have to be out there. It's where people spend their time now. Like most people spend their time.
All his time now on media.
Exactly.
He's giving him shit.
Hey, Sarah, I always spent all my time on social media, so leave me alone.
He's been pushing some interesting videos and stuff that Zapier's working on. That or Zapier, I don't know how to
Zapier.
Zapier makes you happier.
Zapier. Anyway, it's good content. But I've seen him a little more active since that acquisition went through.
Yeah, congrats on that, by the way, Andy. That's exciting.
Thank you very much. I was very active for a long period of time on Twitter with the videos, and then I kind of stopped, and now I getting active again. And then LinkedIn in itself is just like, you put something up and 30 people trying to sell you outsourced IT.
The messages on LinkedIn.
I have a rant about that. As soon as you're hiring for an engineer, they're like, hey, I've got a whole army of engineers in Bangalore. Would you like them? And I'm like, yeah, I'm actually not, I don't need them. But yeah, it's a, you know, the frustrating thing for me about social media, though, is I wish that what actually really got engagement 100% of the time was just like good, genuine content. Yeah. And in fact, it's friggin' carousels on LinkedIn about like how to, I don't know, 7 ways to prompt ChatGPT. And I'm like, no, stop that shit. Like, that is useless. Like, somebody just who's having like a real earnest thing or is like talking about something important, like can we give them the eyeballs?
Or it's like the trolls. Like I kind of respect like all the partners at, well, not all, maybe not all of them, but like at Founders Fund, they all seem to have just like, and I can't tell if they're actually being serious or they're just trying to get the eyeballs and stuff like that, like the Keither boys and all of the, like it's but that's the kind of stuff that gets like the attention.
Can you imagine your life when you're sitting there in Canva building a carousel of how to chat, how to prompt ChatGPT to give you like better results? Like that's your life day in and day out.
Yeah, that's I went to school. I went to school so that I could go into Canva and have its AI generate a bunch of thumbnails for me.
Content creator doesn't sound so glamorous anymore, does it?
No, no. And that's like, honestly, that's a chunk of my life for like the pod and newsletter and stuff like that.
I spend more time in Canva than I'd like to admit.
It's an amazing tool, but also like, I don't know, anybody can use it. I do feel like... Anyway, but that's my take on social media. Like, you've got to be there. I think you have to be your authentic self. And it's going to attract, hopefully, the type of people that want to come work for somebody like you.
Right.
It's sort of like you're always selling your company and yourself.
Right.
And that's what people are going to decide on. And so I think it is important. I do think it is part of company building. You're building the brand of your business. Now, if you don't have a product and you're like, you know, finding product market fit, I do think you probably aren't out recruiting and stuff like that. You do need to be building more.
Right.
But, you know, there's building in public. There's talking about the struggle. There's, you know,
winning people
to your cause.
Claire Vaux is an example because she's also, like, she built this, like, chat PRD thing in public. And she's also really authentic about speaking to her audience, which is, like, I think product managers. I think it's also, like, women in tech. She talks about, like, being a mom and stuff like that. So she kind of knows who her audience is, and she, you know, always puts out helpful tidbits on being a product manager or being in tech or being a mom. And I feel like as she then built this thing, Chat PRD, like she was able to access that audience that she had kind of authentically built kind of as she was finding product market fit. So I think it's interesting, like, even if you don't yet have the full-fledged product, if you know who the audience is and you can, like, authentically cultivate that audience, I think you can't be fake about it. You have to be real. But authentically kind of starting to access that audience even before you have the product out there.
Hey, I mean, I'm building in public and all you're doing here is giving me shit. So what's going on? Zapier it's Central feedback. Is an early beta.
Yeah. But I think, like, what's so great about Claire is, like, it's also a lot about her and her life. And, like, you know, once she posted about, you know, people are asking, how do I find the time to do this side gig when I also have a chief product officer role? And she kind of talked about how she balances it all. And it's like, it's interesting because you get the kind of the product stuff and the career advice stuff, but you also get some of the, like, behind the scenes, and I'm probably like in her target audience market. So I love her stuff. And Andy probably isn't, like, whatever.
Yeah. Sorry,
like,
Andy.
You know,
hate on Andy Day.
There's something to be said for, like, some of that kind of authentic stuff that I think not a lot of people are willing to put out there, but, like, when you are, it really can make the difference and make people want to kind of rally around you.
Yeah, when I worked at Patreon, we called this the concept of, like, everyone wants to be the shadow artist. So they want to understand what it takes for you to do the things that you're doing. And, like, one of my favorite things I think that she posted that I saw was, like, all the places that she had written code in the last few weeks. And it was, like, on a plane, at daycare, in my car waiting for soccer, like, with throw up on my shirt, you know, like all that sort of stuff. And I was like, that probably resonates with a million people out there who are like, oh man, I can very much relate to this situation. And also just, like, it's okay that's where that's happening. You know, you don't have to be at a desk or an office or whatever. Like, Sarah, I love the stuff that you were posting where you were like, here's how I got work done today at the ski slope. And you're like, my kids are in a ski lesson. Great for them. I'm over here cranking in the lodge. Like, here's my computer and me and my cocoa, and it's great.
I've seen that actually live.
Personal. I don't post anything personal on social media whatsoever. Nothing.
That's not your brand.
I don't either.
I'm a very private person. It took me a while to get to this place where I could actually tweet and post on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And the only reason I'm posting on LinkedIn right now is I've got a bet with Sarah who's going to have more followers by the end of the year.
Adam has more than both of you.
You easily, like, just put me, like, way far behind if you did start posting. Like, I think, you know, people want to hear about the journey. Like, you know, you've sold multiple businesses. Like, how did you do it? Like, how did it feel? Like, what were the hard parts? Like, if you tapped into that, I think, you know, it wouldn't even be a competition. But because you don't, like, I have
shy.
A choice.
Like,
you're shy.
I am shy on the
internet. Need a ghostwriter.
There you go.
No.
Yeah. I think we got you another fractional gig here. Oh,
sweet.
I charge a lot, Andy, just so you know.
I'm super cheap.
It's a write-off.
I don't pay in Bitcoin.
Oh, thank God.
I'm curious. So I think we have 20 minutes left. And just thinking about our audience, my personal interest in Adam, your resume, like obviously some things that jumped out at me, obviously being part of Zimride that then turned into Lyft, and also saying that you were kind of like the number two person, and obviously Patreon and all of that. Like, what kind of experiences do you recommend other like founders get that type of role? I know you're like in an advisory capacity right now, but like, what was that, or some like crazy stories that you could share, or just anything around that?
Yeah. Oh man, I have so many great stories from Lyft and fighting Uber. So I joined that company to help them scale. This is how far back this was. Zimride was about long distance ride sharing.
I remember Zimride, yes.
Like San Francisco to LA.
Yep.
And we had this whole enterprise model on college campuses. So like University of whatever, Santa Barbara had like a private ride sharing board and that you could only log into with your Facebook credentials, because then they knew that you were a student at, you know, UCSB or whatever. So I joined to help them accelerate the non-private part of the routes business. So like, how would we connect everyday people to going from San Francisco to LA? You take a bus, a plane, you could ride in stranger's car, and like, it was all going to be under the trust of the Facebook network. And I got there and I was like, this is amazing startup. I've actually never used Gmail Workspace before. Why isn't this Outlook? Like, what am I doing? And so for a little while, I had a bit of a culture shock because it was my first really early company. The company was like 15 people when I joined, all focused on Zimride, like the private business, and a couple of engineers. And so I took over like helping scale the public business. Of course, we had no business model, like no money changed hands on the platform. So how would we ever make money? I have no idea. And then all the things that I learned now about like building a habit forming business, none of those things existed. Like the frequency of taking a ride was like maybe a couple of times a year. So like squarely in the forgettable zone as far as products go. And it just wasn't a good business. And so all the things I know now, if you were like, hey, Adam, you want to go join Zimride? I would be like, hell no. But I was really naive and younger and hungry. And I was like, I'm going to go to the School of Hard Knocks and I'm going to like learn on the job. And so that's what I did. So about 5 months after, we pivoted the whole business to Lyft. And we sold the rideshare business to Enterprise Rent-A-Car, which they've now shut it down because it turns out it wasn't a good business. Right. And like, that was one of those things where like you could tell we had immediate product market fit because it was just like flying off the shelves. Like, and we were only offering service a couple of days a week, a couple of hours a day, and it was fully booked. We couldn't find enough drivers. Like, it was wild. We had to limit demand. We put up a wait list and we still grew week over week because people were just the same number of people were taking more rides. And so it was one of those things where we're like, wow, this thing is on fire. Like this is a big business. And UberX didn't exist. Like it was still black cars. And we believe the peer-to-peer model, which surprise, surprise, that is what won.
That's what happened.
But like, I have stories of like driving a car into the office with a mustache on it and the like a startup embargo, like a PR embargo. We tried to have this thing and somebody blew the embargo. And then my comms person thought she was going to get fired. And John and Logan were like out in the hallway, like whispering to each other. And I went out to check in with him and I came back in. She's like, oh my God, I'm going to get fired. Like, I blew it. And I'm like, actually, no, you're not going to get fired. We just got a cease and desist letter from the state of California. That has nothing to do with the embargo. We're all going to jail. And so, you know, so stuff like that. So do I recommend, so my role, and it eventually morphed into like head of growth for Lyft, but my role in the beginning was like startup athlete.
Right.
It was like, what needs to get done here at the company? And that was, you know, launch and grow Lyft. It was hire a customer support team. It was figure out how we're going to onboard drivers. It was set up the phone system for like calling and texting drivers. Like, it was one part operations, one part marketing. And I've just always been sort of like a generalist kind of person. Maybe that's one of the things that has drawn me to product management so much, is you have to have like facets of a lot of different jobs. But I absolutely think that is a great person to have inside your company. What you eventually call them, who knows? They'll often graduate into something that they're really passionate about as you get more specialized. But like, you need an adult that you can trust that is maybe not the founder of a co-founder of the company. And you can just be like, hey, number two, can you just go over here and figure this out? And those people have to be really comfortable with ambiguity, know what good looks like. Good, not great. Like, you just need good, you know, when you're cranking towards product market fit. Smart, able to make decisions on their own. Like, you know, you kind of, and I think honestly, it's probably even easier now that we have AI that can do like analytics and things on your behalf. But I 100% advocate for that kind of person. And you hear a lot of stories of super successful companies that had that person.
Right.
And in many cases, they still have that person and they're like in some senior role now or something like that. And they're not the founder, but they know where all the bodies are buried, and they figured out how the company, they basically willed the company into success alongside the founders. And I feel like that's what I did for Lyft. I don't want to say that I was solely responsible. There were a lot of other amazing people there,
right?
But like, there are a bunch of stuff that just needed to get figured out, and John and Logan didn't have the time to do it because they were out fundraising and doing all the other stuff and like trying to hold the wheels on the bus while it was rolling down the road at 100 miles an hour. So, you know, you need some other athlete types to do that. That was the first time I'd ever done that kind of job, and I didn't have an appreciation for it until after I left. And I was like,
yeah,
while you're there, you're like, man, I'm not good at any of these things. And it's just like, turn the crank. And after I left, I was like, wow, I learned a lot through osmosis and just being there and doing things and like stepping on a million rakes and falling on my face a bunch of times. And like, that's pretty valuable. And so now if I can, I mean, and so after a few of those cycles, it's what led me to doing advisory work. I'm like, if I can help other people skip some of those steps, help some of their team members, give them a little bit of guidance, that's infinitely powerful. And, you know, I have like 20 years of doing that stuff now that has given me experience that I didn't have. Couldn't do the work that I do now without having gotten those punches in the mouth. valuable to have somebody like that. I think
I've worked with this person you're describing twice at two companies, same person, was not a junior person by any means, shape, or form. And then had this person at Val, and they work with me at Zapier. So this I relate to a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They were never the founder, but they were as important as the founder to a large degree. And it's very hard to find somebody like this. I cycled through at Val of a number of people before I found this person again, modeling it off the same individual at.
What was the role, Andy, that you hire for?
At Val, at Nana, it was called Chief Revenue Officer, which was really Chief Product Officer, COO, Revenue, Marketing, you name it. Pretty much everything but engineering, they would get their hands in. And then at Vowel, it was head of product, but additionally kind of got their hands dirty with me on marketing, on ops, on CS, you name it. But Nana was very PLG, so they're different. Vowel is very PLG, so they're different type of functions. So generally, I guess Ali put this role as like a COO-ish, but not actually managing like G&A and ops and legal and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Andy and Sarah, do you guys like to go the I'm assuming you do just advisory stuff right now. It's not, you're obviously not at, is it an advisory role at Mozilla?
No, he's full-time.
Let me just describe the different flavors of this, because I actually think this is important for founders. There's sort of differing levels of commitment. Advisory is generally one of the lower levels of commitment. When I have an advisory role, I will spend an hour or two a week with predetermined people at the company and then some asynchronous time. But I'm helping them work through specific problems, like how might we build the growth model for this business? And we'll do a workshop and like stuff like that. But outside of that 1 or 2 hours a week, there's not a lot of other synchronous interaction. Then there's like fractional roles. So I think that can be fine as long as you have, maybe you have a junior head of product and you need someone to kind of mentor them because you don't know what to do as the founder. It's not your skill set. I think advisor can be helpful there. Then there's like fractional roles, which is I need a chief product officer temporarily and part-time. I got a bunch of good executors. I need somebody to help me think about like, how are we going to sequence this over the course of the next year or two? That tends to be, you know, maybe half-time, couple days a week, something like that. And then there's what I'm doing at Mozilla, which is interim executive role. And I'm basically a full-time employee with an end date. And so I'm still a 1099 employee. But I'm like running stuff, you know, and you might have direct reports. You do all the things that a full-time in-house executive would do, except for someone like me, I don't want to be a W-2 employee. I've actually architected my entire life around being a 1099 employee and doing these stints for like a year at a time and then taking a little bit of a breather and doing some other stuff. And so that's kind of the most extreme. I think more people at the earlier stage probably play in the advisor or fractional space. Yeah. Yeah. But I did, there was a Series B company that I was just the interim CPTO for called Resort Pass. It's a Series B marketplace.
Yeah.
They're not small, you know, $100+ million of GMV a year. Like that's non-trivial. And they needed a full-time person, but they knew it was going to take a while. And the CEO had a lot of executive roles to hire. And I was like, hey, I'm available. I can do this job. You don't have to worry about it while you go and figure out these other pieces. And he was like, great. So I built a product strategy. I hired people. I like, you know, ran the engineering team for a period of time. And then I helped hire my replacement, who came into a full-time role after I'd been there for a year and was like, didn't have to do some of the, you know, BS that you have to do.
The politicking.
The reorging. And I also helped him figure out, like, what's the kind of person I need at the stage that I'm at? Yeah. So I think that was great. And, you know, he didn't have to worry about hiring and firing me. Like, it was like, we've got a contract. I'm going to do these things for you. I know how to run a product and technology org, and, you know, we'll check in, and you're going to end up a lot better off than you are right now at the end of this 9 to 12 months or whatever it is. And that's exactly what happened. It was great.
That's
pretty cool.
Founder's dream. That's a thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, I think there's a lot of folks doing this because, look, here's my take on this. It's hard to hire executives as a startup. There's a high failure rate, just like there's a high failure rate for companies. There's a high failure rate culturally. You really want to take your time, and yet you need someone in the chair doing some work because time is of the essence. And so, you know, this is a good bridge strategy, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think also, like, you can't always hire someone like you. Like, you can't afford someone with that amount of experience and skill level, but you don't know where you can quite skimp And so like putting you in the role to, you know, figure it all out and then be like, okay, you don't need someone with this amount of years doing this thing. You actually just need someone really good at this. I'm going to find you that person. Boom.
Yeah.
And then you kind of get someone who's more junior, but amazing at the role. And you don't need to pay them, you know, millions of dollars. And you've kind of figured that all out. You know, I need that for a VP of sales, by the way, if someone can do that, because I've been wearing that hat for a while. It's really hard, especially when that's not your background.
Yeah. And I've known founders who have gone, they've run a rigorous process. They've hired a VP of sales. And then 6 weeks into the job, they're like, oh, I've made a terrible mistake.
Right.
Like either culturally, this person's different than what I expected, or they're not operating at the right level of elevation. And like, you don't have time. Like that can be a long process. So like, if you have somebody that you can plug and play and then gives you the time to figure it out, like you can make progress while hedging a little bit. It's a hedge. So I'm very biased because this is what I do now, but I'm a fan of this type of thing. And there's more people I think who went through my couple of decade long career and are opting into this too, especially if people like me want more flexibility. Like come all the way back to what we talked about. Like my kids are 9 and 11. I like to spend time with them and do stuff with them. And what I like is that when I turn off my computer, I'm not thinking about work 24/7 the way that I was when I was inside of a startup building it.
Yep.
Now, that could be bad if you're a founder and you're like, I want somebody that's thinking about this 24/7. But, you know, for a lot of the businesses that I work for, it's worked. And I don't get burned out. And I get to strike the right, you know, structure and balance for what I need in my life. And then maybe that changes 2 years, 3 years from now. We'll see. Yeah. But it works for me now. And I think for a lot of companies, it works.
Well, I think from the founder's perspective, it's like you could either go and you could try to search for doing an executive search, and it may take up to a year, and you at least you're getting something, and it could be somebody that like you that's probably really awesome, and to plug that gap is just huge versus just having nobody in that role doing nothing.
Right.
That makes a ton of sense. I wish there was a more, I don't know, content or people, or I've actually never really kind of heard people doing this before, but that makes a ton of sense.
So we are coming up on time.
Yes.
Adam, parting words, and where can people find you on the internet?
Well, I feel like I've said a lot of words, so I don't know that I have a lot of parting words for people, but I'm just super appreciative of being on the show, and hopefully I said something that's valuable for founders.
Definitely.
You can find me on the internet in a lot of places. Mostly, I think my biggest group is on LinkedIn. That's where I put a lot of the Startup Dad podcast stuff. It's where I publish newsletter findings. But my newsletter is the Fishman AF newsletter. So fishmanafnewsletter.com. And then startupdadpod.com is where you can find all the wonderful episodes that I've published. And they're on all the various platforms and things like that. But those are the two places. LinkedIn, and then those two, the part, as you said, Sarah, my media empire.
Yes. Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, and thanks for everybody for listening. And that is a wrap.